Hello, this is KPTZ, Port Townsend, 91.9 FM on your radio dial. I'm Marianne McNellis, and this show is called Our Town. Have you ever wondered who the people are that you see every day around town? The guy riding on that recumbent bike, the woman behind the counter scooping your ice cream, the guys hanging onto the side of the fire engine, the front desk clerk at the Palace Hotel. This show, Our Town, profiles some of the fascinating people who live and work in Port Townsend. We talk with people who make up the eclectic mix of Jefferson County. We talk about their lives, their dreams, and how they ended up on the northwestern edge of the USA. We'll be talking with firefighters and foodies, bus drivers and teenage beauty queens. We'll find out what makes them tick and what they think about living in Port Townsend. Listening to Our Town is a way to meet some of Port Townsend's authentic and even eclectic people, your neighbors, your friends, and particularly the people you don't know yet, but you'd like to meet. Today we're going to be talking with Scott Rosecrans, a lawyer and former prosecutor for Jefferson County. Scott is credited with shepherding the Jefferson County special courts, the drug courts and the mental health court, through their formative years. Not everyone understands how these programs work and how they contribute to the fabric of our town. Thanks to these courts, not everyone up for a drug offense ends up going directly to jail. But let's start at the beginning. Welcome to the show, Scott.
Thank you. Thanks for having me here.
So are you a Port Townsend native?
No. I was born and grew up in upstate New York and eventually made my way to the West Coast via Texas.
Via Texas. What were you doing in Texas?
I always wanted to be a policeman, so I went down there in the early 1970s to get a degree in police science. Met my wife, and that was a good enough reason to stay, and got a job with the Houston Police Department, and went to law school, and here I am.
What school did you go to?
Sam Houston State University, which back in the early 1970s, there were really only four colleges that would give you a degree in police science, and that was one of them.
Why did you want to be a cop?
Always wanted to be one, and you know, the corny thing they ask you when you go into the police academy is, why do you want to be a police officer?
Right.
And it's like, well, I want to help people, as corny as that may sound, but it's actually true.
Yeah. Yeah, my uncle and godfather was a cop in New York City. So you were a cop in Houston.
Right, yeah, for a little over 12 years. Street policeman, worked undercover, and then I was the sergeant over the DWI task force.
Wow. So when you were undercover, describe some of the undercover outfits you might be in.
Right. I was assigned to the Vice Division, so you know, my job was to go into bars and make sure people weren't being served too much to drink, or go into prostitution houses or modeling studios or bookstores and look for that kind of illegal activity. So I would just kind of dress the part. Sometimes I would dress up like I was a doctor, you know, wearing hospital scrubs to blend in. One of my other favorite outfits was dressing up as a tow truck operator, and we actually had a tow truck that we drove around in. So you just kind of blend into the community and just kind of see what happened.
Huh. But it wasn't like, did you wear wigs or phony mustaches or anything like that?
Yeah. No, you know, we would just, you know, grow our hair, grow a beard, shave it off. You know, the weird thing was I was in uniform, and when I went to the Vice Division, I actually went back into the same area that I patrolled, and I thought, well, you know, they'll know who I am, but right. Once you take that uniform off, you just kind of blend in.
You're invisible.
So, yeah.
Or maybe people just look at the uniform and they don't see the person in it.
Well, that's true in more ways than one.
Yeah, I think that might be true. Well, can you isolate in your mind one of the scariest things you did in your days as a cop in Houston?
Sure can. I was, you know, when I was working, actually there was two of them when I was working undercover, but one of them was I had made a case on a street prostitute, and she told me to meet her, you know, down in her room. So she was walking down to the room, and I, you know, radioed my partner. I said, hey, I've made a case, and we'll be in room 122. I'll get a uniform unit to just, you know, come through the door and bust me and take me off and, you know, keep me cool. And so we were in the room, and she was, you know, kind of putting the full court press on. She wanted to take care of business.
Let's get it over with.
Yeah, I know, get it over with. I'm trying to stall things a little bit, and I'm, you know, slowly, you know, unbuttoning my shirt and taking off my cowboy boots. And about that time, yeah, the knock on the door came, and it was a police officer, and he came in, and he was a senior officer. He recognized me, but he did a pretty good job of keeping me cool. Told me to get on out of the room, and so I grabbed my cowboy boots, and as I was running out the door, I didn't know that he had a rookie that he was training. man, the last thing the rookie saw was him go in and me run out. And the next thing I heard was, you know, freeze and a few other adjectives. And I looked over and this rookie was laid out over the hood of the car and he was drawing a bead on me. And I thought,
oh my
wow.
God.
Yeah. He just got out of the academy. I knew he could hit me 75 times out of 100. So I came to a screeching halt and he patted me down and his partner came out and said, you know, let him go. He's okay. And let me go. And later on, the rookie came by the vice office to apologize. And of course, I thanked him for not, you know, shooting me.
But, yeah, right. But woo.
It would have been a justified shooting. You know, I mean, he was just there to back up his partner, but it was scary nonetheless.
I think so. Yeah, I think so. Yeah. Well, why'd you decide to make the transition from being a cop to being a lawyer?
Well, my father-in-law was a lawyer in a small East Texas town. And after about 8 years on the force, he just approached me and said, you know, have you ever thought about being a lawyer? And I said, well, no, not really. And he said, well, give this some thought. And I thought, well, that'd be a good way of, you know, moving out of the city and being able to provide a living, you know, for my wife and my kids outside of the city. And luckily for me, South Texas College of Law had a part-time program for working students. And I crammed a three-year program into 4.5 years and passed the bar, quit the police department after 12 years, and started practicing law with my father-in-law up in a small rural East Texas county.
Uh-huh. And what kind of cases did you mainly handle?
He did, you know, wills and probates and uncontested divorces and had a pretty good civil practice. So I provided the manpower and the muscle to do all the criminal cases and nasty divorces. So I handled the criminal cases and the contested divorces. So we had a pretty good team.
What were the main kind of cases? What was the big tickets happening there?
Well, you know, I started out doing criminal defense for the first 5 years, and even though it was a small county, you know, I had everything from, you know, misdemeanor marijuana to murder. I defended a couple murder cases, defended some, you know, serious assaults, some robberies, some rapes. You know, even though it was a small county of about 20,000 people, it had its fair share of drugs and violence. And so I started out doing that for the first 5 years.
Wow. Well, you know, one thing I've always wondered about the legal system is this. I know the discussion between a client and a lawyer is privileged. But let's say I'm up for a murder charge and we're in private and I said, yeah, you know, I shot that creep. And then you're supposed to be defending me. How do you wrap your head around something like that?
Yeah, that was a difficult concept for a lot of other people to understand. It's like, well, gee, you were a policeman 1 minute and now you're defending, you know, murderers and robbers and rapists and whatnot. How can you do that? And you just have to say, well, you know, my job is a lawyer to provide them the best possible defense and to protect their rights and to make sure that they get a fair trial if they want a fair trial. You know, and that's how I did it. And you know, especially with the two murder cases, it's like, wow, you're defending a murderer. Well, yeah, but you know, I want to make sure that they get the fairest trial they possibly can. And remembering that your client is the Constitution.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, because I just, you know, it's sort of hard to understand. And it's interesting because you actually were on both sides.
Right.
You know, you were catching the bad guys and then you were defending the bad guys.
Right. And then there was a vacancy for district attorney because the district attorney got appointed judge. So then I became the district attorney in that small county.
Aha. Uh-huh. So, and yeah. What exactly does a district attorney do in the real world instead of TV?
there they call it the district attorney. Here we call it the prosecuting attorney. It's the same thing. You know, you're the attorney that represents the state of Washington or the state of Texas. And we did everything from misdemeanors to murder and also, you know, advised county and county officials. You know, so and in a small county, you know, you have to be prepared to do a little bit of everything. I did everything from traffic court to prosecuting several murder cases.
Wow. Well, so you were in Texas for how many years?
35 years.
And so why did you end up in Port Townsend? How did you get here?
While my daughter was in college at the University of Texas, she had a job working at a fishing cannery on Kodiak Island, and she met this dashing young fisherman from Seattle and fell in love. Moved up here after graduating and called us one day about 8 years ago to inform us that she was pregnant, and the rest is history. And I've been here 7 years as of Monday this week.
And where are your daughter and son-in-law? Where do they live?
They live over in Edmonds, and then my son and his wife live down in Scottsdale.
Okay. Well, that gives you a great place to go visit in the winter.
It does.
Okay. Well, so how did you pick Port Townsend out of all of the, you know, great Pacific Northwest?
Well, I had to find out first what it would take for me to get licensed in Washington, and I was required to take the ethics exam. So while I was waiting for the results, I just did like a two-hour search around Edmonds and just started sending resumes out.
Right.
And Julie Dalzell, the elected prosecutor here, got one of my resumes, and she was looking for an experienced trial attorney and said, you know, well, would you fly up for an interview? I said, fly up for an interview. Okay. So I did. I flew up and interviewed with Julie and also interviewed with Deb Kelly over in Clallam County. And much to my surprise, at age 56, I got two job offers.
That's great. Why did you pick Port Townsend out of the two? What was your thinking?
A lot closer to my grandkids.
Okay, well, that's a pragmatic reason.
Yeah. And it's a beautiful town. It's a beautiful area. My wife liked it, too.
Yeah. Excellent. So you started with Julie as an assistant prosecutor?
Right. So I was her assistant felony prosecutor for a while, and then
What year was that?
I started here in June of 2008.
2008, okay.
Right. And I hadn't been here very long when Julie came to me, and she said, you know, I think I've they had a pretty good run, and I'm not going to run for re-election. So then had no thoughts or desires to run for, you know, another office, but, you know, had to run to keep my job.
Yeah, why not?
Why not? Yeah.
Okay, so when you became prosecutor, I mean, anyone who holds an office looks back over what's been done before, and they look at how they can do it and incorporate the good things and maybe work on some of the things that aren't quite as good as it could be. So what were your thoughts about change?
Sure. And I was fortunate enough to, you know, take over an office that was already in pretty good shape because Julie had done a pretty good job. But what I was really excited about was the fact that they had a drug court. And I, you know, had always wanted to be, you know, involved in some sort of a drug court.
Okay, well, let's just sort of stop here because not all of our listeners really even know what a drug court is.
Right.
So explain the concept.
You know, the drug court started decades ago. I think the first one was maybe in Georgia or Florida. I don't really recall. And they've been steadily, you know, inching their way westward since then. But it's an alternative to, you know, sending somebody to prison because prisons are expensive. You may commit a felony offense, but, you know, it may not be necessary to send you to prison if we can identify what, you know, the root of your problem is and, you know, give you a shot at correcting your behavior and not going to prison. And that's what drug courts, you know, are designed to do.
And so is it limited to people who it's like their first offense?
You know, when they first started out, it was brand new. So a lot of them would do first offenders, nonviolent type crimes, or, you know, what we call the low hanging fruit. They were really pretty easy. And if they messed up, you know, nobody really noticed. You know, if they, you know, they went into drug court because they, you know, stole their grandma's debit card or forged a bunch of checks. It was, you know, nonviolent, harmless type crime. And if they messed up, nobody was going to be upset. So it really was geared early on to, the nonviolent, low-risk type offenders.
Mm-hmm.
So after I had been at the drug court for a while, I went to a seminar to learn more about it.
Right.
And sat in on a session where the moderator really encouraged us to think about expanding our drug courts to what they called the high-risk offender. And it wasn't high risk like they were at a high risk of going out and hurting somebody. They weren't necessarily, you know, violent offenders, but they said high risk meant a high risk of relapsing or reoffending. It was more probable that they would go out and use again or commit some sort of a property crime. So they said, you know, think about it. Your high risk offender that has a pretty good rap sheet, they're the ones that are responsible for a huge amount of the crime, you know, in your community. So if you can change their behavior, crime's going to go down. So I thought about it and came back and sat down with the judge. I think it was Judge Verser at the time and Ford Kessler and Richard Davies, the public defender, and said, you know, look, I just went to this seminar and here's some material on it. And I'd really like to think about putting some high-risk offenders into drug court.
Well, so how do you pick the high-risk ones? What criteria do you have?
Fortunately, I think of being in a small community is you kind of already may have known them because you've been dealing with them for so long. You look at their rap sheet. Somebody in the system knows them from the sheriff's department, or maybe they've already been, you know, they've gone through probation or something like that. So you kind of look at it. You read the report. You know, you also talk to the police. You know, how do you feel about me putting this person in drug court? You might talk to the victim and say, you know, look, I know they broke into your house and stole all your stuff, and it's going to be hard getting your stuff back or getting restitution. And the only way we can do that is maybe making a productive system. So, you know, you try to get everybody on board. You know, and it's also high risk for an elected official. I mean, it's easy to put the low-hanging fruit in, but putting one of these high-risk offenders in, I mean, if they go out and really mess up, you know, then King 5 News is, at my office door wanting to know, you know, why did you do this?
Yeah.
That kind of thing.
Because
so.
You're really talking about people who've had multiple convictions, have been in and out of jail. That's
right.
The kind of person you're calling high risk.
Right. And what we found is we've had a few high-risk offenders here recently. What we found was the ones that had, and it was a high risk to them, because if they messed up, they were going to prison. They had a pretty good offender score, and they may be looking at 5, 8, or 10 years in prison. And what we found was they actually did the best because they had the most to lose.
Huh. You
know, so it's kind of, you know, now when I look back on it, it's like, that was a no-brainer.
Huh. Well, how do you talk people into it?
You know, it's harder, you know, the first offenders or the second offenders, it's harder to get them to do the drug court because they don't have that much of a risk. You know, they say, well, you know, I committed a C felony or a B felony. I'll take my 30 days or 6 months in jail and just go on about my business. So with the high risk offenders, they're looking at some pretty serious time. It's like, yeah, okay, I'll give this a shot. But it comes with, you know, hopefully they're at a point where they, you know, they want to stop and, you know, I guess get off the vicious cycle. Like I say, it's harder with the first or second time offenders.
Okay. So let's say I was one of these high risk offenders and I've got 5 convictions, mm-hmm. and you approach me. Well, what does it entail? I mean,
right.
What,
so the first thing
we have to do.
Yeah. After I, you know, after, you know, we would clear things with law enforcement or clear things with the victims and, you know, give a good hard look at them. We would make the offer to the public defender,
right.
and say, or to the lawyer. It could be a hired lawyer. It doesn't really matter. And say, you know, look, I'm willing to go ahead and give Joe Smith a shot at drug court. And if he wants to, you know, number one, get help for his addiction. And number two, avoid another one of those unpleasant trips to prison. And then, you know, the lawyer goes and talks to him and tells him, you know, the pros and the cons. You know, the pro is, you know, you've got an offer from the prosecutor not to, you know, send you to prison and maybe get some help. The con being is you're giving up your right to a trial. So if you get into drug court and you mess up, we just have a little hearing in front of the judge and the judge finds you guilty and then the judge sets your punishment. So you are waiving your right to a jury trial.
But, you know, to the layman, if you use the term court, that is sort of, it implies you go in and you state your case and then you're, you know, sent to jail or dismissed. But that's not what really drug court is. It's a longer commitment.
Oh, right.
But explain what you're committing to. What would I be doing if I agreed to it?
Sure. So, you know, we give you a bunch of papers for you to go over with your lawyer, you know, what you will do and what you won't do. And drug court in Jefferson County is up to 24 months. Now, there's been a few folks that we've kept a little bit longer than 24 months. They were, you know, a little slower for whatever reason. But basically, you're agreeing to being in drug court for 24 months.
But it's really a program.
Oh, it is.
Okay.
Yeah. I mean, we call it a court because every Thursday morning you show up in Superior Court and Judge Harper is sitting there along with the public defender and the prosecutor and Ford Kessler from Safe Harbor Recovery and a sheriff's deputy. So you have to show up every Thursday morning to report on your progress, and you know, you and 20 or so other of your fellow drug addicts are sitting around the table, and you know, we talk about your progress and how things are going. And once you've got, I think 270 days sobriety under your belt from the time you start drug court, then we might let you come every 2 weeks. And then once you get 365 days sobriety, continued sobriety under your belt, we might let you come, you know, once a month.
So is it only once a week that you have to go to this meeting? Or is there anything else involved?
Sure. It's once a week that they have to come to drug court. But depending upon where they are, you know, Safe Harbor has them come in for counseling. They have to go to meetings. And what we found is a lot of the people in drug court are dual diagnosis. You know, they may have a drug problem, but they may also have some sort of mental health issue. You know, so we try to help treat that too. So they're busy all week long, whether mm-hmm. they're going to meetings or going to Safe Harbor, things along those lines.
Do you have to be straight to start?
Oh, no. We've had some that, they're in jail, and the only reason they may have 30-day sobriety is they've been locked up for 30 days. You know?
Yeah.
So, we get them. You know, we've got some that say, oh, I haven't had any drugs since I got arrested 90 days ago or whatever, which, you know, that's fine. But the clock starts over. So, no, you don't have to be clean and sober to start. We've had some that have been pretty shaky.
Well, where does the money come for drug court?
Well, you know, and that's the great thing about it was, you know, Julie and Judge Mahan started drug court back in, I think 2003. There was no money. They just said, you know, this is a good idea and we're going to do it. You know, while I was, you know, a participant in drug court, there really wasn't any money. It was basically the public defender was, you know, donating, you know, one of their lawyers. The prosecutor's office was donating a lawyer. The judge was basically, you know, making time in his busy schedule to go ahead and do it. And as was Ford Kessler, the sheriff's department was sending a deputy, and nobody was asking for any money in return. Now, there is a special fund. It's a substance abuse fund, and I think Jefferson County was one of the first counties to take advantage of this fund, where it's the 0.1% sales tax, and it goes into a fund, and you know then everybody jockeys for position trying to get some of that money. And fortunately, I think over the last couple of years, we've been able to get a small piece of that pie and direct it towards Safe Harbor so that they can use it to offset their costs.
Many of the people would be homeless who would be coming into this court. Do you help them getting homes and getting jobs?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, that's one of the things that we realized was, you know, they were couch surfing or they were living in an unhealthy environment, you know, full of drugs and whatnot. And we just didn't know how to address that. And sometimes just good things fall in your lap. Kathy Morgan is like the director of housing for OLECAP, and she came to us one day and she said, well, look, you know, she says, I've got the Haines Street cabins that we used to use for the homeless shelter, but we've got other resources now. I'd like to go ahead and offer the Haines Street cabins as housing for the drug court people. And it was like, wow, you know, so
great.
We've got a place for these people to live.
Right.
You know, so and that was probably one of the biggest turnarounds for us was having clean and sober housing for these people to live in.
Mm-hmm. And then what about jobs? Do you help?
We encourage them to go out and get jobs.
Right.
And you know, we try to convince the community that these are really pretty good folks. You know, and several times the participants in drug court will say, well, nobody's going to hire me because I'm a drug addict or I'm an alcoholic or whatever. And I'll say, no, not really. I said, if you think about it, you know, I mean, the workforce is already full of people that do drugs. So it's no great surprise to some employer that he has an employee that does drugs. If you go and sit down with this employer and say, look, my name is, you know, Joe Smith. I'm a drug addict, but I'm working a program. What that conveys to the employer is, oh, this guy is working a program. He may actually show up clean and sober for work. Because that's what the employers want.
Yeah,
so they really are pretty good. And I've been fortunate enough to know some people from living here where I've managed to help several of them get jobs. You know, and I mean, it's so now they got a clean and sober place to live. They got a job. They got a little money in their pocket. You know, and they start feeling better about themselves. They start feeling, you know, more human.
Well, this is clearly a subject you're pretty passionate about.
I graduated from Sam Houston in 1974, so I guess it would be safe to say that I've been doing this for four decades. And again, with all the, you know, I've arrested murderers, I've defended murderers, I've prosecuted murderers. And I would have to say, with everything that I've done in 40 years, that drug court has probably been, you know, the most satisfying and rewarding thing because you really are helping people. You're restoring families. You know, when they come to drug court and say, I'm talking to my mom. I got to see my grandfather before he died. He got to see me clean and sober. You know, I've got a job. I've got my kids back. You know, I had a police officer come up on the street and say, hey, I hear you're doing pretty good. Keep up the good work. What they do validates what I was doing.
Wow.
You know, so, yeah, it was
incredible.
Really great. Really great.
Well, you know, Scott, believe it or not, we're just about out of time here.
I could talk about this all day.
Yeah, I think you could. You're listening to KPTZ. Port Townsend, 91.9 FM. I'm Marianne McNellis, the host of the show called Our Town. Today, our guest has been former prosecutor Scott Rosecrans. We've been talking about Jefferson County's drug court. Scott was instrumental in expanding the program, but Scott's side of the story, as passionate as he is only one piece of it. It seems to me, in order to understand the impact of drug court, we need to speak with a couple of the people who actually went through the program and our success stories, people who've clawed their way out of the pits. They had serious addictions, and they've turned around to become contributing members of society. People who are making their families proud of them. So for the next episode of Our Town, I'm going to be interviewing two former addicts who'll discuss their experience with addiction and their experience with drug court, how they did it, a long and probably very difficult road to sobriety. Be sure to listen to that show, which will air on June 30th and July 2nd. Meanwhile, keep listening to KPTZ Port Townsend 91.9 FM for more dynamite, eclectic, local programming, and be sure to go to our website, kptz.org. You can listen live. You can also find podcasts of former shows. This show will be up for several weeks, so you can listen to it online. And as I say, the next episode will feature two people who went through drug court. So I want to thank you very much, Scott, for being part of the show.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
Our Town is an original KPTZ production created by Marianne McNellis and engineered by Sonny Flores.